Okay, the War Scroll, reflect. What did you find? What was interesting about it? What shocked you? What didn't shock you? I know you've slept since then, but what? Yeah, what's up?
Where did they get those random numbers, it seemed like? It is because like they're so sure of like they're going to be commanders like in the age of 40 and 50, and there's going to be 52. Like, how are they so sure of these random numbers?
Multiple different theories upon that, but you have to understand the genre that's writing. Does everybody understand the fancy French word genre whenever I say that? The type of writing. Numbers and those types of writing aren't usually numbers in the way we think of as mathematics. A lot of times those numbers will be more symbolism driven. They'll be more, like for example, the book of Revelation. There's not a single number in the book of Revelation that is literal. It is all figurative numbers. Why? The genre tells me so. Therefore, whenever he's saying stuff about 40, the number 40, which we'll actually talk about, not in this class, but my next one, so you won't hear it at all, has quite a lot of significance in Judaism. Think of different times that 40 appears throughout the Old Testament. 40. Say it again.
40 years
in the desert. The time period of preparation before we have a new creation of people, right? In the land of Canaan. Where else is 40? Yeah, we have the king connection with 40. What else? What was that? In the New Testament, it'll pick up with Jesus fasting with 40 days, which will be significant once we get to the end of chapter 1. What else? What's that? Moses was up on the mountain for 40 days, right? So 40 starts to carry this type of significance that can then carry over into other documents. So when they're using 40, it probably has something along the lines to do with the complete number of time of preparation before a new creation or something along those lines. So yeah, you have to also figure out a way how to read the document in order to understand what the document is saying. And the numbers in particular, you have to think symbolism because that's what's heavily laden in this, right? Correct? Yes? No? Okay. Yes?
But I still don't get like why they would think that just because in Revelations, it was like a divine prophecy from God, you know, he got a vision. But these are just, I mean, this isn't like a, obviously this isn't like a prophecy from God about how the Messiah is going to be like.
From our perspective, it isn't. From their perspective, it was. The War Scroll, the community that developed the War Scroll was known as the Essenes, the Qumran community, which what they did was, during the time of the Maccabean Revolt, there were several different reactions to what was happening. We talked about the Maccabean Revolt last time, right? Several different reactions. One of them developed the Pharisees, which we'll talk about eventually. One of the reactions developed the Sadducees, and one of them developed the Essenes. These two decided to stay in Judaism, in Jerusalem. Well, not technically Jerusalem. The Pharisees were on the outside, but these two wanted to function within the system. The Essenes, who wrote the War Scroll, they move outside of the community. And they say, the way we are going to try to preserve God's truth is by separating ourselves from all the pagan Jews. We are the Jews of the Jews, is what the Essenes were saying. In their documents, they saw it as a prophecy from God of what would happen. And they held on to that until they were wiped out during the Jewish revolt in 66 to 70. So they did see it as a prophecy from God, the teacher of righteousness, the Ketim that would come. Did you notice the Ketim? Who do you think the Ketim was? The Romans. What are they envisioning? They're envisioning the destruction of the Romans at the hands of the sons of light. Who do you think the sons of light were? Yeah, the Essenes, the Jews. God's true people fighting the army of Belial, the Ketim, who they are describing Rome as on the side of Satan. You see how this is working? This is a prophecy. They did believe that because of their preservation, because of what they were doing, that God would intervene and destroy the Romans. Else, what else? What other things did you think about? What other things did you catch? What were they longing for? Yeah, go ahead.
I had a question. Did the other Jewish sects view the Essenes as like like that was from God, or was it just the Essenes?
It's probably just the people within the Essenes, because the Essenes didn't even believe that the compromising Jews would be the ones on the Sons of Light necessarily. So the people weren't big fans of the Essenes. They saw them as a strange, weird community, which is one of the reasons why people think that John the Baptist may have been from the Essene community. It's possible. Is it probable? Maybe. There's some intersection there that makes it possible, but we can't say one way or the other. Nevertheless, they were not seen as part of mainstream Judaism. And if you're not a part of mainstream Judaism, once we start talking about the political webs that are in the society, you're not very well received. So that's a good question. Yes?
So did the other two Jewish groups have a similar view of the Messiah?
Where would their primary documents be from? Old Testament. What else?
Talmud
wasn't officially put together until the second or third century. I mean, the oral traditions would have been around. And that would have been more Pharisaic than it would have been Sadducean. They would have gotten theirs, though, from the intertestamental documents. Stuff like the Wisdom of Solomon. Stuff like the Testament of the Patriarchs. Which we've already read some of those already, showing, yeah, we did last class period. Showing that even in those documents, what was being longed for, what was being lusted after, was a violent Messiah to come about with fire. The reason why I had you read the Essenes document is because we've read in class some of the Sadducean and Pharisaic documents, but I wanted you to see some of the actual fringe Judaism group's perspective was somewhat in line. It's just who they thought were going to be the ultimate victors or those exalted would have been different from the Pharisees and Sadducees. Does that make sense? The Essenes would have seen themselves as being primarily exalted over and above the Pharisees and Sadducees who had compromised. So there's within Judaism, there's a war. And yet they both align on one point. God is going to liberate them through violence. Now, Chase brought up another document that he read. And Chase, why don't you go ahead and just describe what you read in addition to the war scroll?
When I was searching the index for the war scroll, there was a little document later on that was called The War of the Messiah. And I read that. It was just a couple little pages, a lot shorter. In the intro, it talked about how, like, the language in it, that they think it's an ending to the war scroll that was just like lost and then refound in a different cave and stuff. And it has a lot of the same feel as the war scroll, but instead of being kind of general about God saving the Jews, it gets a little bit more Messiah-ish with like kind of like a singular person saving them.
See, and this is what is interesting, and we need to understand this as well. That's really a good addition. I didn't even know that was there, so I'm glad that was there. What you have, even within communities, is not a clear understanding of what the Messiah, if there was even going to be a Messiah. Now that's interesting. If there was even going to be a Messiah, but if there was, how would he function? Okay, you following with me here? You're reading the war scroll and you see God moving. That's what they all believed. God was going to liberate his people. He was going to move. How exactly he was going to move was not always agreed upon. Sometimes, a lot of the time, there was a messianic figure. But that wasn't necessity. What was the necessity? That God would liberate them, right? How he did it was not as their concern as much as that he was going to. So what you see with the war scroll is you see God as the primary agent, but then you see this ending of the war scroll within the same community, and it's the messianic figure doing the same thing that God was doing in the war scroll. Violent liberation of his people. To accomplish what four things? What are the four things they were looking for with the Messiah or God's liberation? Return from the exile, right? What does that mean? Whenever we say return from the exile, what does that mean? What's that? Yeah, they're coming back, right? Because what happened in the time of Assyria and of Babylon? What happened to the Jewish people? Are we awake on this Tuesday morning? What's that? They were scattered. And they were taken away from their land, displaced. Read Daniel, just the first six chapters, and you'll get that feel. They were totally displaced, and what they were longing for was to come back to their land, to establish their cultic worship, to be able to worship God in the exact way He articulated in Jerusalem. What was another thing they were longing for?
Reign of Yahweh.
The reign of Yahweh at Zion, right? They wanted God to reign once again. Not these pagan gods, these pseudo gods. They wanted Yahweh to reign once again. Another thing, what is it?
The exaltation
of the nation of Israel. They wanted to be the ones in power. They wanted to be the ones that had control like Babylon. They wanted to be exalted. And what's the fourth and final thing that accomplishes all of this? The defeat of the enemies. And you saw that very clear in the war scroll, didn't you? This is the general tenor of Judaism at the time in which Jesus comes to be. Whenever Jesus comes into the situation, this is the general mood and feel and tone of what Judaism was longing for. They didn't care exactly how, but if you're going to claim to be a Messiah, you need to accomplish four things. Return of the exile, the exaltation of the nation of Israel, the reign of Yahweh, and the defeat of the enemy. And if you don't have these four things, you're not the Messiah. You see how that works? You're an imposter. And that's how we begin the Gospel of Mark. In the beginning. The beginning of the Gospel about Jesus Christ, the Son of God. From a Jewish perspective, what jumps out to us there? We talked about this last class. What's that? Christ! What are they talking about whenever they're saying the word Christ? What is the other word in English that would be a good translation of the word Christ? King! He is the Anointed One, the Christ, the Christos, the Messiah, Anointed One. But the Anointed One is the King. That's King language. What's another thing that jumps out to you? That if you were Jewish, you'd be like, oh, that sounds familiar.
In the beginning.
Arche, in Arche. One of the other ones would have been euangelion. What is the Greek word euangelion? Good news. The beginning of the gospel or good news of Jesus Christ. In the old, well, matter of fact, this is a pretty important word in the Gospel of Mark. In the Gospel of Matthew, we see it used four times, and it's used in strategic locations. In the Gospel of Mark, it is used seven times, and three times in the first 15 verses. Do you hear that? Remember in Principles of Interp, maybe you haven't taken it yet, but in Principles of Interp, if I see one word being repeated in multiple times within a short pericope, what should I think? What? It's important. Something significant is happening with this word. Right? We see it in Mark chapter 1 verse 1. We see it in Mark chapter 1 verse 14. And Mark chapter 1 verse 15, which ends the prologue. We'll see it again in 8:35. Now notice in 8:35, where the rest of the times it comes, the other four times it comes in significant locations. 8:35. This is right after the confession of Peter. That's an important section, isn't it? And good news probably related to that in some way. 10:29 is the fifth time this is used in the Gospel of Mark. In 10:29, this is right after the interaction with the rich young ruler. And what happens at the end of chapter 10? Do you remember from the very first class? What happens at the end of chapter 10? Not the event, but the structure of the book. We shift. Yes, chapter 11 starts to shift into the 6-7 chapters for 1 week. It's at a major juncture. Chapter 13, verse 10, when he's describing the destruction of the temple, he uses the word euangelion. Significant event. Chapter 14, verse 9, is the very last time we see euangelion, the good news. And it's right after Jesus' anointing and right before the Lord's Supper. You see what's happening? He'll keep on doing this throughout the gospel. That's ironic. Throughout the book of Mark, he'll say, don't forget the good news. And always it puts us back to chapter 1, verse 1, which starts us off in a very politically explosive verse. You see what he's doing? He's saying, don't forget the point. Don't forget how I started. Don't forget the good news. In the Old Testament, the Septuagint, what's the Septuagint? Just so we're all on the same page. Yes, the Greek version of the Old Testament. In the Septuagint, this comes up in really four different types of places. Two of them will be kind of the secular level, and two of them will be a key theological level. Euangelion occurs at the accession of kings of Israel. In 1 Kings 1:42, when Solomon ascends to the throne, they call it Euangelion. Good news. Whenever there is, number two, whenever there is a military victory, in the Old Testament, the Septuagint will use Euangelion. 2 Samuel 4:10, at the news of Saul's death, it was considered Euangelion. 2 Samuel 18:26, the death of Absalom, David's son in the enemy army at the time, they call his death Euangelion. You see what's happening. Good news is a political word that describes kings' accession to their throne and military victories that begin a new regime, otherwise known as a new creation, in a sense. On the theological level, we find it on two ways. Number one, the establishment of God's reign in the Old Testament, the Septuagint, uses the word Euangelion. Good news. You see this in Isaiah 40, verse 9. You see this in Isaiah 52, verse 7. Psalm 96, 2, and other places. Okay? And the final way Euangelion is used in the Septuagint, once again on the theological level, is it describes the deliverance of God. The deliverance of God. You see that also in Isaiah 40, verse 9, and Isaiah 61, verse 1. So let me go through those again. Euangelion in the Septuagint is used in four ways that we can split into two categories. The first two are on the secular level. The accession of the king of Israel, whenever he ascends to the throne, and the military victories in the nation of Israel, they have Euangelion associated with each of those two avenues. The other two ways are the theological level. The establishment of God's reign and the deliverance of God. So what do you notice about all four categories of Euangelion in the Septuagint? All four of them fall into what category? What's that? Because that will affect the way the word's being used, possibly from a Jewish lens, in Mark chapter 1, verse 1. All four of them, the accession of a king, military victory, God's establishment of his reign, and God's deliverance of his people. What are those all describing? Kingdom stuff, right? Political language. This is the establishment of God's kingdom. That would make sense for Euangelion to occur right next to Christos, wouldn't it? Would that surprise a Jew? If we're talking about the Christos, the king, the anointed one, that comes to liberate God's people, and we see Euangelion next to it? No, it wouldn't surprise me. I would expect that. Why? Because of the way in which the word was used throughout the Old Testament. And then there's one final phrase in verse 1 that from the Jewish perspective is quite significant. And it's the phrase, the Son of God. Now we need to do a little deconstructing so that we can actually construct what a Jew would have heard whenever they heard this, okay? Now hear me very carefully, because you could misquote me very poorly with what I'm about to say. Son of God, in the first century, from the perspective of a Jew. You hear that? You hear my caveats? Son of God, in the first century, from the perspective of a Jew. Okay? They would not have thought of divinity. Are you tracking with me? We see Son of God, what do we think? Jesus is divine. Now, is that inaccurate? No, the 3rd and 4th century, they do interpret the phrase Son of God as divinity for Jesus. They use it that way. However, when it was very first being read by a Jew, the way they would have understood it as not divinity, what would they have understood that language as? Kingship language. Where does that come from? What's the idea behind, the logic behind that? Son of God equals king. What? The Romans did it. We'll get to the Roman perspective in a minute. That is accurate. And we'll get there in a minute. But what about the Jewish perspective? In the Old Testament, what is the logic behind Son of God equaling king? Say it again. He's the appointed one of whom? Of the Jews. Of Israel, right? And what was Israel referred to in the Old Testament? Children of God, or even sometimes the Son of God. So if you are the key representative of the children of God, the Son of God, then you being called Son of God would make sense. And that's the way they called kings. You see it through the Psalms. You see it through the prophets. The Son of God. Well, matter of fact, you even see it in the promise to David. He will have one reigning on his throne forever and ever, etc. Son of God was a way in which they would refer to the king. So what we have from a Jewish perspective, I'm reading Mark chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning, a new creation is occurring. Of the gospel, euangelion, which would mean the establishment or deliverance of God's reign and his people. About Jesus Christ, messianic language, king language, the Son of God, this is the king. You see what's happening? Are you starting to see why I think this is the most politically explosive verse that begins any of the New Testament books at all? But now we have to change to a second lens, and somebody referenced it already. We've seen it from the Jewish lens, and it's very clearly political and kingdom-like. What's the second lens? What's that? Yes, Rome. The Roman lens. Now we have to look at what is occurring here from the perspective of the Romans. Oh my goodness. I think I cut out a bunch of my notes. Yeah, we'll just go this on the fly then. Sweet. From the perspective of the Romans, we have to have a couple of things put into place before we can understand how they would have seen this. Number one, you have to know something about the imperial cult. Does anybody know what that means? In sum, what?
They went to worship the emperor.
Yes, to worship the emperor as a god. But now let's be a little bit more specific in that definition. Normally, the way it was implemented in the time of Augustine, whatever that was, Augustus was the first emperor where this actually arose within his time period. So you're talking middle of the first century BC towards the beginning of the first century AD. That's whenever this imperial cult worshiping the emperor as a god arose. But Augustus would not allow them to worship him specifically or technically. What would he do? What would he defer the worship toward? His father. Who was whom? Does anybody remember who Augustus' adopted father was? Octavian's father? Julius Caesar. So if Julius Caesar, whenever he dies, he becomes a god, and you are his son, what does that say about you? What is your title then?
Son of God.
And if you're the son of God, if you are the son of a deity, then you probably should be revered, or at least listened to, right? You see how that works in Augustus' favor, even though he's not being technically worshipped? Why was he not wanting to technically be worshipped? Think Roman history. What had happened to his dad? Yeah, who was he assassinated by? The Senate. Why? Too much power. So whenever people say, we want to start worshiping Augustus, he says, well, don't worship me because, you know, I'm just a lowly servant of the Principate. Instead, you can worship my dad as a god. Because, well, I mean, of course, I'm the son of God, but that's just by default. It's not my fault. That's my dad. See what he's doing? He's giving himself power by not allowing people to worship him. Very shrewd. Augustus was brilliant. He had to navigate a pretty explosive political terrain in order to secure the power that he really wanted. And he did it very well. From the time of Augustus, the typical way of worshiping or of honoring emperors was after they died. After they died, the Senate would vote. The people would come back. How are we going to? Was this a real person, or was this a real deity, or was this an imposter? The very first time there was a shift in this was by the third emperor. You have Augustus, Tiberius, kept it the same way. Then there was a guy by the name of Caligula. What was different about Caligula, those you Roman history buffs? What did he do with the imperial cult?
He wanted to be worshipped during his lifetime.
Yeah. He said, why wait until I die? I'd rather experience it right now. So Caligula is the first emperor that says, no, you don't need to wait to worship me. Worship me now, because I am a god. As a matter of fact, him and the Jews, I think we've talked about it in here, they had a bit of a clash. Where the Jews destroyed one of his imperial cult statues in one of their synagogues whenever a Greek put it in there because the Greeks didn't like the Jews. The Jews destroyed it, and he says, you're going to blaspheme me? You're going to challenge me, a God? All right, fine. I will put my statue up in your temple. And Josephus says, had it occurred in 41, the temple would have been destroyed then. But some weird thing happened. Honestly, what's really weird is one of his guards was... This is the way Suetonius tells it. It's very strange. The guard was insulted because Caligula referred to him with an effeminate term, and the guard got mad and killed him. Totally random. The guy was evil as all get out. He had a bunch of enemies, but that's the reason why he died. So anyway, Caligula means little boots. So anyway, little boots was killed because he called a guy a woman. And so as soon as that happened, Claudius came to power and he said, stop the statue, because he knew all the problems that would have caused. And then it kind of goes back to normalcy under Claudius. And then Nero becomes psychotic again. And Nero says, no, I'm not going to wait either. You worship me as a god while I'm alive. Normalcy occurs then for the next, six or so emperors. The last emperor to say, worship me as a god while I live, was Domitian in 95-96, which is significant for the book of Revelation. So that's the imperial cult. What's the main purpose of the imperial cult? To worship the emperor as a god. But the one that is reigning is not the god himself. He is what? The Son of God. The beginning of the gospel about Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Remember what's happening at the time of the composition of this book from 68 to 70? What happens during that time period? I'll give you a hint on my fingers. There are four emperors in the year of 69. And they're each trying to fight for what title? Son of God. And Mark says, let me give you a fifth. You see what's happening? Son of God. Okay, there is, though, a place where... we need to read an inscription first. Okay. The words beginning and good news, which are also used in 1:1, was also something that was wrapped up in the imperial cult, the worshiping the emperor as a god. And it comes in what is known as the Priene calendar inscription. Priene calendar inscription. I'll write the word Priene on the board, that way you know I'm not lying. Priene. The Priene calendar inscription. In 29 BC, a contest arose amongst the empire. They said, who can honor Augustus the best? Actually, the way they said it is, who can honor the god the best? And Augustus is saying, oh, I'm not a god. Yes, I am. You see how he does that? Who can honor the god Augustus the best? For 20 years, they tried to come up with an answer to win the contest. Whoever would win, the city would receive the crown of the imperial crown, which is a very high honor. 20 years. In 9 BC, this was the winner. And I'm going to read you the inscription, okay? It says, it seemed good to the Greeks of Asia. Asia Minor is the region that we're talking about here. They're the ones that won the contest. In the opinion of the high priest, to declare, since providence, which has ordered all things and is deeply interested in our life, has set in most perfect order for our lives by producing Augustus and filling him with virtue for the benefit of mankind, sending him as a soter, a savior, both for us and for our descendants, that he might put an end to war and establish all things. Notice the language. And since he, Caesar, by his appearance, excelled even our anticipations, surpassing all previous benefactors, and not even leaving to posterity any hope of surpassing what he has done. Wow. And since the birthday of the god Augustus marked for the world the arche of the euangelion. Since the birthday of the god Augustus marked for the world the beginning of the good news. You hear that? Marked for the world... Oh, sorry. I was just reflecting upon the significance of that. Marked for the world the beginning of the good news for the world through his coming, which Asia resolved in Smyrna. It is hard to tell whether the birthday of the most divine Caesar is a matter of greater pleasure or of greater benefit. I can't figure out which one. If it just delights me more or if it benefits me more. It's a contest that cannot be solved. We could justly hold it to be equivalent to the arche of all things. And he has restored at least to serviceability, if not to its natural state, every form that had become imperfect and fallen into misfortune. He restored everything. Therefore, people would be right to consider this to have been the arche of the breath of life for them. The beginning of the breath of life occurred when? At the birth of the god Augustus. Therefore, it seems proper to me that the birthday of the most divine Caesar shall serve as the same New Year's Day for all citizens. The winner of the contest was Asia Minor whenever they said, we are going to reorient the entire calendar around the birthday of Augustus. Why? Because that's when everything, all of existence truly began. This is the arche of the Evangelion, the beginning of the good news of the Soter, the Savior that has come to give us peace. What does that sound like? Help me. What does that sound like? Yeah, doesn't that sound like Jesus coming? Doesn't that sound like Jesus' purpose? Doesn't it sound like Mark chapter 1, verse 1? The beginning of the Evangelion, the arche of the Evangelion, the beginning of the gospel about Jesus Christ, the Son of God. What's he saying? Is Mark saying anything? Maybe I should ask that question. Is he?
Superimposing Jesus over Augustus.
Mark is saying this. I know your claims, Rome. I get it. I know what you're claiming. I know you think that whenever Augustus was born, that was the beginning of all things. I know you think that everything was restored back to its original state whenever the Son of God was born. I know you think that truly the good news is the birth of Augustus, the Son of God. But it's the fifth Son of God that I'm throwing into the pot in the year of the four emperors that truly is the beginning of all things, that truly brings the good news, that truly is the Son of God. You see what he's doing here? What does that make? What does that do for our interpretation of the Gospel of Mark? What does it do? Or does it do anything?
Kind of adds an attitude towards it.
Man, has a little bit of an attitude, doesn't it? Yeah?
Can I say that it stands in a stark contrast to a lot of things in Rome at that time? Like with what he says.
You can say it, explain it though.
Well, I mean, I don't know. Well, just like right there, it draws attention. Like you were saying, that a lot of what Mark's writing, it stands almost in opposition to what Rome is doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe it's the same like throughout the Gospel of Mark.
Absolutely, yeah. Did you hear what he said there at the end? That's exactly right. What he said there at the end is he said, if this is the way the book starts, what makes me think he drops this topic throughout the rest of the book? Doesn't it make sense that the way you begin a gospel sets the tone for the rest of the gospel? We've already talked about that, right? And how does he set the tone? These are fighting words. You see, a lot of times what we do to Jesus, in every gospel study, what we do to Jesus is we make him completely apolitical, only spiritual, something that has to do with my private faith, but nothing to do with the public world. Sound familiar? Matter of fact, we're getting ready to move into a political season where there's going to be, you know, big election talks. And I guarantee you, one of the key things that the politician will try to prove is that he has a private faith, but it does not affect him in the public arena. Won't that be something they'll try to prove to us? Yeah? They can't let it affect them in the public arena. Why? Because that could influence the way that they're ruled. You see what's happening? Your faith needs to be compartmentalized. And we've done that in theology. We've made Jesus just about him just reforming my heart. But you have to understand, Jesus didn't come just to reform your heart. He came to reform the world. He came to establish a kingdom that you are supposed to be, and you're supposed to be engaging in the reformation process as a part of living out his mission. You see what he's doing? What this opening verse says is, you can't read the rest of the Gospel of Mark as if it's just this, you know, well, I mean, I don't know a good word to use it, this, you know, pansy Jesus. Jesus was crucified not because he was a nice guy. He was crucified because the Romans and the Jews both clearly understood his political message. They got it. And if you start off a gospel like this, you're going to get some heads turning your way. The arche of the euangelion about Jesus Christos, the Son of God. Oh my. Whether you're a Jew or a Roman, you're sitting there going, I have a problem with that. The Jews' key problem is the word Jesus. And Rome has a problem with the rest. You see what's happening? Jesus' coming was politically explosive because he was claiming to be establishing a kingdom where kingdoms were already reigning. And kingdoms don't like that too much. As a matter of fact, one of the four emperors to reign in 69, with the very last one, the one that ends up reigning throughout the 70s, was an emperor by the name of Vespasian. Vespasian. We've talked about him some. The reason why I'm bringing him up right now is because Josephus says something about Vespasian that kind of brings both the Jewish and the Roman lens together and sets Jesus, at the time of the writing of Mark, sets Jesus in stark contrast with the empire once again. First of all, who is Josephus? That's important to ask. He is a Jewish historian. Actually, he was a Jewish rebel at the beginning of the revolt in 66. He was one of the generals. And what happens? Does anybody know what happens to him? Yeah, he gets captured, basically. And he surrenders as a way of preserving his own life. He surrenders, and then he becomes a Roman propagandist to the Jews. What better person to convince the Jews to stop fighting against the Romans than one of the Jewish generals? That's convenient. So Josephus becomes a turncoat. He becomes a traitor. He becomes one that's from the Jewish perspective saying the Romans are God's instrument. And whenever he meets Vespasian, this comes very clear. He looks at Vespasian, and in Jewish Wars 3.8.9, in case you care, Josephus says this. He says, "You imagine, Vespasian, that in the person of Josephus you have taken a mere captive. But I come to you as a messenger of greater destinies. You will be Caesar, Vespasian. You will be emperor." See, at the time, Vespasian was just a general that was putting down a revolt in Judea. "You will be emperor, you and your son here," his son being Titus, who was emperor from 79 to 81. "Bind me then yet more securely in chains and keep me for yourself. Don't kill me. Use me. For you, Caesar, are not master not of me only, but of land and sea and the whole human race." So the first thing he does whenever he meets Vespasian after being captured is he says, "You're actually my king. You're the one that will be king of the world. You will own everything. I know it doesn't look that way right now, but I'm telling you, a time's coming when you're going to rule everything." And Vespasian says, "Wow, actually, I kind of like this guy." And so he keeps him. And what ends up happening is the lore around Vespasian continues to develop because of Josephus' pen. Josephus not only claims him to be king of the world, he then claims that he is the Messiah. He claims that Vespasian is the Messiah. Listen to this. Jewish War 6.5.3 says, "Thus it was that the wretched people were deluded at that time by charlatans and pretended messengers of God." Who are the wretched people Josephus is talking about? The Jews. He's calling his own people wretched and deceived by charlatans claiming to be messiahs, but they're not. "While they neither heeded nor believed in the manifest portents or the signs that foretold the coming desolation of what? The temple of Jerusalem. But as if thunderstruck and bereft of eyes and mind, disregarded the plain warnings of God." They were missing the signs, he says. And what were the signs? "So it was when a star resembling a sword or a scepter stood over the city in a comet which continued a year." And you're going, what does that have anything to do with Vespasian being a Messiah? Let's keep reading. 6.5.4 says this. "But what more than all else incited them to war was an ambiguous oracle likewise found in their sacred scriptures." What's their sacred scriptures? The Old Testament. to the effect that at that time, one from their country would become ruler of the world. One from their country. From. Notice the ambiguity of the prophecy. One from their country would become the ruler. From meaning from their people, or from meaning somebody from that geographical location. You see how that? See how he's going to twist this? Anyway, if you don't care about this, you should, because this is actually really cool. Anyway, whatever. This they understood to mean someone of their own race, and many of their wise went astray in their interpretation of it. The oracle, however, in reality signified the sovereignty of Vespasian, who was proclaimed emperor on Jewish soil. Now, what you have is you have a star and a scepter and the rising of Vespasian on Jewish soil. All these three elements being attached to Vespasian. And that's significant because of Numbers chapter 24, verse 17. Notice what I use to describe this. We're going to be bringing the Jewish lens and the Roman lens together through Josephus' interpretation of the events. And when is 66? When is the revolt happening in relation to the Gospel of Mark? During the writing of the book. Okay, so we're intersecting at date and at time period and at geographical location. Numbers 24, 17 says this. A star, notice the first symbol, a star shall come forth out of Jacob, out of the land of Israel. A scepter shall rise out of Israel. It shall crush the forehead of Moab and break down all the sons of Sheth. What is that passage interpreted by Josephus saying? That if they would have seen the star, and if they would have seen the scepter and known who was coming out of the land of Judea, they would have been able to recognize Vespasian for who he truly was. Who was he? According to Josephus, he's saying he was the Messiah. Because Numbers 24:17 was used as a messianic passage over and over and over again. From the Testament of the 12 Patriarchs, Testament of Judah in 24:1-6, it says this, "And after this there shall arise for you a star from Jacob in peace." A star from Jacob in peace. What's it referring back to? Numbers 24:17. "And a man shall arise from my posterity like the Son of Righteousness. This is the shoot of God Most High. Then he will illumine the scepter of my kingdom, and from your root will arise the shoot." You see what that passage does? It says Numbers 24:7 is the Messiah. 17 is the Messiah. And Josephus says, that's funny, because Numbers 24:17 is describing Vespasian. So not only does he proclaim that Vespasian is king, he also proclaims him to be the Messiah. And in fact, it even goes one step further. For in Jewish Wars 4:10-6, it says, "Every city celebrated," talking about Vespasian's ascension to the throne, "the Euangelion, and offered sacrifices on his behalf." On reaching Alexandria, going back to Rome to claim his throne. On reaching Alexandria, Vespasian was greeted by the Euangelion, the good news, from Rome and by embassies of congratulation from every quarter of the world, now his own, the whole empire being now secured in the Roman state, saved. Beyond expectation, Vespasian turned his thoughts to what remained in Judea. So what is happening in this opening verse is this. The emperor that takes control at around the time in which Mark was even being composed is called Messiah, King, Soter to Cosmo, the Savior of the world, the one that is the Euangelion, the Son of God. And Mark opens up and says, actually, the beginning of the gospel about Jesus Christ, the Son of God, that's the one that really claims those titles. You see what he's doing? This gets really significant whenever we look at the bookends, and this is how we're going to end today, of the Gospel of Mark. Because chapter 1, verse 1 brings up a concept that will be repeated in chapter 15, verse 39. The phrase Son of God is only used 3 times in the entire Gospel of Mark. 3 times. 1:1, 3:11, out of the mouth of a demon, mind you, and 15:39. And guess who calls Jesus Son of God in 15:39? Well, let's read it. Exactly. And when the Roman centurion, who stood there in front of Jesus, heard his cry and saw how he died, he said, "Surely this man was the Son of God." Reflect on that, please. How does the book begin and end? Claiming a title that only belonged to the emperor, for Jesus. And the very last time Son of God is uttered is by a Roman centurion, one of the leaders of the Roman army. And he says, the way the Greek syntax is lined up, it puts the emphasis on this. This man, as opposed to that man. This man is the Son of God. And from the mouths of even Romans themselves, you hear in the Mark, in the Gospel of Mark, proclaiming for Jesus that I don't care how many people are staking claim to being Son of God at the time in which this book is written. There is one Son of God, His name is Jesus, His name is Jesus, and even the Romans agree. You see what Mark's doing? He's creating a situation that really matches the time period in which his audience is living. A politically explosive time period. And what he's doing is he's looking at him and he's saying, I'm not going to alleviate the tension, I'm going to make it worse. And if this leads to your death, that's fine. Because after 1539 comes 1601. And that's the resurrection. And the church in Rome would say, whoa, there's no place to hide except for in Jesus. All right, you're dismissed. I love you guys. See you tomorrow. Oh, really quick, look at your syllabus and note that we do not have class Thursday or Friday. I'll be in England. Sorry. I'll be thinking of you when I'm there. Not really. Maybe. It might cross my mind. Anyway, we won't have class those 2 days, but that means I want you to start hammering on some of the assignments that are coming due. Okay? Okay? Love you guys. See you tomorrow.
What are the first and second paper choice on the syllabus?